Welcome to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm Ashley McGuire of the Catholic Association, and we are glad to have back with us Maddie Kearns of the Free Press. She has a great piece covering this trend that we have seen of late, where self-identified Catholic influencers use church teaching to justify anti-Semitism. Maddie, you title it, "What's a Good Catholic Meant to Do?" And you pose the question, "Self-identified Catholic influencers have twisted church teaching to justify anti-Semitism, slander, and other sins of speech. How are church leaders supposed to respond?" So, big question that we will jump into, but thanks for taking the time to join me today, Maddie.
Of course, thanks for having me.
So, let's start out with the phrase sins of speech. Can you break down what you mean by that?
Sure. So the Catechism talks about sins that damage the reputations of others. So we're supposed to safeguard one another's reputations. So these are sins of slander, that's saying things that are false in order to harm another person's reputation. Detraction, which is saying things that are true, and that is telling a third party who doesn't need to know the information, negative information about somebody else. So this is, I think, one that a lot of people don't even think of as being a sin, but actually it's probably one of the most common serious sins that we all do in the interest of justice. But that's very different from just going around telling everybody that this person has this particular sin or struggle. And then there's other things such as rash judgment. That's jumping to negative conclusions about somebody before you've really had the chance to sit down and consider the facts or give people the benefit of the doubt. And then, of course, we can use our words to put into concrete terms sins of our heart. So whether that's something like anti-Semitism or hatred towards whole groups of people, we might use our words to kind of promote those things which the church teaches are serious and sinful.
Do you see a certain point at which this really took off? Especially, you know, I think as we're both Catholics, you know, it's nothing new to see these sins of speech, slander, and even I would add in just profanity, just like lewd speech, which I don't know if theologically that's considered another sin of speech, but you know, the Howard Stern era is what I grew up in, but it's seeing it among the Catholic influencer world feels relatively new. Do you see a point at which this sort of took off in that world?
Yeah, definitely. I think social media and the ascent of social media, maybe in the last 10 years and maybe even more so in the last 5 years, there's all sorts of perverse incentives to do with living in an attention economy. You know, you stand to gain a lot of followers, a lot of likes, a lot of attention if you say things that are very inflammatory, if you say things that are very sensationalized. And of course, a lot of the time you are saying things about other people. And I think as that's become more common, people have become numbed basically to the consequences of sins against the Eighth Commandment, sins of speech. People have become sort of almost casual in their attitudes to these things and don't necessarily even realize it. I mean, I will say, you know, that when I was reporting this piece, it did actually prick my own conscience, because I think there's all sorts of ways that I just hadn't really been thinking about the gravity of the way I use my words, like maybe not in print, but at least privately. And I was kind of encouraged in a way to have quite a lot of people reach out to me and say, "Oh, I read your piece. It really made me think more seriously about this and pricked my conscience." Like, obviously, it's just demonstrates that these are things that have become so common and such a prominent feature of our public discourse that it's easy for people to get sucked into it without even realizing that's what they're doing. So I absolutely agree that this has become more and more common as social media introduces all of these sort of perverse incentives and very high profile people engage in this. There's also been, if we look at our political discourse, there's definitely been a cheapening as polarization has affected America. And, you know, since sort of 2016, there's been, you know, it's no longer, "Well, we agree to disagree." It's the other side is not just wrong, they're like deranged and evil and are bringing about the demise of America. So there's that sort of heated sentiment as well, which again just radicalizes people in ways they don't even realize.
Right. You spoke with Michael Knowles in your piece, and you write, "But for influencers, quote, slander and detraction are job requirements." Quote, the Catholic Daily Wire podcaster Michael Knowles told me only half jokingly that he refuses to engage in these sins, quote, probably explains why my ratings aren't as high as they could be, end quote, he added. But what does it profit a man to gain another million listeners, but to lose his own soul? Do you agree that with his premise that slander and detraction are sort of job requirements to be an influencer today?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree that these are the things that generate, or they're the easiest and fastest ways to generate large followings and large revenue. And it's the grabbier you can be, the more kind of tabloidy you can be, then the more you kind of assert yourself, and certainly the algorithm. That's the way there's a, as I say, there's a perverse incentive. He manages to engage without doing that. Michael Knowles himself, like, it's certainly true. Could he have more listeners? Could he have more followers if he was more inflammatory? Probably, but I think he's also an example of someone who's clearly like successful in spite of trying not to do these things. So it might just be a question of how successful you're going to be. As opposed to you can't succeed at all or be heard at all if you refrain from the sins of speech.
Well, it certainly was interesting to me to watch the rise of Carrie Prejean Boller in terms of perverse incentives. There was a period when she was really kind of manically attacking Catholic hierarchy after her anti-Semitism tirade that got her removed from the Religious Liberty Commission, where she was gaining something like 10 to 15,000 followers a day. And now as a platform that's really built on the scaffolding of sins of speech.
Yeah, no, that's definitely an example of how this can be used for your own the purposes of your own notoriety. I think really the only answer that we can have about this is to sort of rise above it, because there isn't, and this is the point that Michael Knowles was trying to make that I think was perhaps lost even among some of his colleagues at the Daily Wire. So he was put on the spot by Ben Shapiro, who said, you know, you should speak in stronger terms against Candace Owens. And Michael Knowles has said repeatedly that Candace Owens is wrong in her behavior, especially her attacks of Erica Kirk, the widow of Charlie Kirk. He said very clearly that this behavior is wrong, but he hasn't sort of attached a whole list of adjectives to Candace Owens. And his explanation to me was, well, on the one hand, first of all, we have to be careful about detracting people ourselves, even if we're trying to sort of correct public scandal. There's a way, you know, we should really be striving as much as possible to be describing behaviors that we disagree with as opposed to condemning people. But then the other point he was making is there's a way that you can start to basically profit from the performance of public morality. So if you start saying this person is evil and deranged, and let me just go on a big tirade about how they're evil and deranged, you have actually entered the algorithm. You've entered the attention economy, and you too have started to gain followers that way and gain profit that way. And is that really in the public good? Is that really something that is countering the forces that you say you want to be countering? I'm not sure that it is. And so these questions are more complicated. And I think it, you know, you mentioned Carrie Prejean Boller, and I think the example of the way that she went after Bishop Barron and Cardinal Dolan sort of relentlessly until finally he did issue a statement saying we disagree, like this is not how first of all, this is not, you're misrepresenting the church's teachings on Zionism and Israel and everything. But also, I was not, you were not removed for the reason that you say that you were removed. And you could tell that he was issuing this statement reluctantly out of a sense of public duty, because at a certain level, if people who claim the Christian, the Catholic identity, and claim to be speaking on behalf of the church, which Carrie Prejean Buller has been doing, at some point, a bishop does need to come forward and say, I actually am speaking with the authority of the church here, and that is not correct. And that's basically all he said. He didn't call her names, he didn't condemn her, he just said her account is false. And but you could tell he did that reluctantly, right? And in partly because he was being personally attacked. So it's what I explored in the piece is part of the dilemma that Catholics find themselves in, because on the one hand, you want to speak the truth clearly, but on the other hand, you don't want to detract people yourself. You also don't want to accidentally empower people by adding to their notoriety, when, especially when what they're really after is attention and sort of making a brand for themselves. So it's a tricky one. And I think that bishops and priests are particularly sensitive to things that they do and say coming across as being politicized. And that's just a fact of modern life now, that they have to be very careful about these things because they will be perceived a certain way, even if that's not fair.
And it does really seem like, unfortunately, this is probably not going to be an isolated incident. The whole Prejean going after two cardinals. I mean, even recent events in American politics that have involved certain Catholic public figures have shown that even if Catholic prelates don't care to engage in what you call the literal hellscape of our online discourse, they may have to, for the very reasons you just outlined, which is that the public correction is required in some cases just to clarify church teaching when certain figures are using their platforms to twist church teaching in the name of Catholicism. I liked the example that you gave of Lila Rose, back to your point about not detracting. Where she made a caveat about conscience. In other words, trying to give Candace Owens the benefit of the doubt that maybe she doesn't know, which, she's a hard person to give the benefit of the doubt to, but I thought that was a magnanimous it was a magnanimous way to try to call out somebody. But you also interview our beloved Catholic Association chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry, who is a regular feature of our show, and he had very pointed words about slander. Tell us a little bit about what he had to say about Catholics who willingly engage in slander.
Well, they're endangering their salvation in a very urgent sense. He made clear that the church teaching says that you can go to hell for slander. So it's not something to take lightly. And I think especially it's easy in some senses to focus on sins that are demonstrable, like if somebody kills somebody else. Well, there's like a it's a provable fact whether or not they killed somebody else. Whereas slander, people, I'm sure, for instance, Candace Owens would reject the implication that she has slandered people, because she would say that she's a truth seeker, and no, she and and this is where Lila's point comes in. What if somebody genuinely believes what they're saying is true, even if there's no evidence for it, even if it's wrong? Well, then sins start to morph into, maybe it's not slander, maybe it's detraction, or maybe it's not detraction, maybe it's rash judgment. But in any case, all of these sins of speech are grave matter. So even if the person hasn't, the Catholic Church obviously teaches that to commit a mortal sin, you need to have full knowledge and consent, and it to be grave matter. Now, even if you don't have full knowledge, and even if you don't have full consent, it's still grave matter. It's still really, really bad. And so you have an, and I think there's also one thing I know Monsignor Landry has spoken about before, is there's a misunderstanding of what a conscience is. A conscience isn't just your opinion. it's inform we have it we all have a duty to inform our consciences by objective standards, and the objective standards, the church is clear on what these are. They are the magisterium of the church tradition, the catechism, the commandments. And if you are to really take all of that really seriously and inform your conscience, then there is absolutely no justification for some of the things that, to just take one example, Candace Owens is saying. Whether she knows that, whether she fully understands that, that's not for me to say. But what I can judge is the action, and I can say that is clearly very seriously wrong, like a lot of what she's saying. And I think the other thing that Lila Rose said, which I thought was just really on point, was she was talking about, it's not merely the person saying it, it's also how do we respond. And unfortunately, there are a lot of Catholics who consume this kind of content, and I don't know whether they're doing it in the spirit of, it's titillating, it's gossip, it's exciting, it's entertainment, but like these are all things that we should not be doing. Like if it, I feel like, if I'm in a conversation and somebody starts slandering somebody else, I should at the very least feel really, really uncomfortable and want that conversation to end. It would be better if I could stand up for the person being slandered or disagree or give some sort of witness, but at the very least, my witness should be I'm not consenting to be part of this. And I think that's something that we've lost when it comes to the online blogosphere, podcasts. This is something people just really don't think about. They don't think about the fact that they are choosing to listen to something that is poisonous for their soul. And I think Monsignor Landry, as you say, was very clear that these types of speech are very simple and very degrading.
Well, that really gets to a question that's been burning in my mind since before you wrote this article for a while now, but it kind of it, the quest the title of the article, What's a Good Catholic to Do, gets at the question, which is how do we walk the line? I mean, so much of discourse has moved to places like Twitter and social media, whether we like it or not. What people call the mainstream press is not as relevant as it used to be. Conversations are happening in live time on these platforms. And it feels to me like I used to never even look at Twitter, but now I feel like to be an informed person, I have to look at certain outlets that I don't care to. And pushing this even further, and I imagine this is something you really had to deal with in writing this piece. When I almost didn't even want to say their name. Some of the most vile influencer figures out there, I never looked at anything that they posted, but they've become such a part of the national conversation that there have been times where I felt like I needed to see it, watch it for myself to understand what's true, what's not, what's false, what's being taken out of context. And so, how do we walk the line as Catholics of being informed, understanding exactly what's going on for these conversations that are, very relevant, very much a part of the national conversation, without, I don't know, while exposing ourselves to this? I mean, we can't just bury our heads in the sand and not look at any of this. Or can we? I don't know. Do you have thoughts on that?
I think that there not everybody has to be seeking out this stuff. And like, I mean, we're a sort of distinct category because we're in journalism and it's our job to do some of this stuff so other people don't have to, but like not everybody needs to be doing that. And I think if I if somebody at my parish was like, Candace, who? I would actually be sort of relieved. I'd be like, oh, well, that's great. Because I spend so much time online, maybe I have a distorted sense of like this person's reach. And that's actually reassuring to me. And also, I understand why a lot of priests, even if, or bishops, even if you were to say to them, they'd be like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't know who this person is. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but there are certain people for whom this is the responsibility. One I would say is people in journalism, Catholics who have these platforms who are aware of this problem and are able to kind of just put out the facts and do it in a way that's, as you say, not taking things out of context, just sort of saying like these are the red lines and these are how this person's crossed them. And then there's people I will say I do think somebody like Candace Owens as bishop does perhaps have an obligation to say something. This is happening, and he's her shepherd, and he must be made aware of this problem. I'm sure. Well, I know that they're aware that of who Candace Owens is and the fact that she's an active member of the Diocese of Nashville. So he really is somebody who I think should probably say something, and any priests in her life should say something to her, not necessarily publicly, but they should say something privately at the very least. I don't know if these conversations have happened or are happening. So it depends what your role is, but it's not necessary for everybody to trouble themselves with this and poison their minds with this, but they should be aware at the very least of where the dangers are so that they can avoid certain podcasts, I think. And so I think, somebody like Lila Rose is actually a good example of she's engaged with this as much as she feels she needs to, but she's certainly not wasting all her energy and all her time talking about this. She's engaged, and she said very clearly what she thinks, but she's focusing her podcast and her efforts and her talents on the good, the true, and the beautiful instead of getting bogged down in other people's toxic nonsense.
Right. It's just, I got to imagine it's so hard if you're a young person out there and you're trying to, you're seeking things out. You're seeking out information, ideas, and you see, these people with these huge platforms and think they have these large platforms because they have worthwhile things to say. And it's sort of a brave new world in that way. But just one last question on that note, on a more positive note, are there a few examples that you can think of or offer to our listeners of influencers or people who have used their platforms well, who are worthwhile? I mean, Bishop Barron is to me the gold standard of someone who comes to mind, but who do you like to follow?
Yeah, so I would say that I'm not a typical consumer of these things because I'm a reporter, so I'm listening to so many different people, not all of whom I agree with or would feel comfortable endorsing their whole package. But in terms of people who I think are really honest and really sincere and very careful in how they talk about other people, I think certainly my colleagues at the Free Press, we try to do that. I would say Ross Douthat at the New York Times is really a very good example of somebody who engages charitably. And I know I've mentioned her several times, but I also do admire Lila Rose in her efforts to rise above this and to give people the benefit of the doubt, even when they don't deserve it. So certainly there are channels out there, and of course EWTN does a great job as well of this, of just exploring these things without descending to that level. But yeah, but I mean the best thing people can do if they want to figure out should I be listening to this person, shouldn't I be listening to this person, is to read the Catechism and just get a sense of whether the person they're listening to is just habitually violating these moral precepts or not. And once you've read what the Catechism says and you've listened for 10 minutes, then you should have a fairly good idea of like whether or not this is worth your time.
Right. Well, Madeline, thank you so much for coming on and talking today about this very important topic. Where can our listeners follow your work?
Sure. So I'm on social media for those who venture into that dangerous territory. So you can find me on X at Madeline Cairns. And also you can find my writing at the Free Press, so the fp.com.
Well, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks so much.
Every morning, the Catholic Association reviews all of the latest news and sends our subscribers a carefully curated collection of the most important news of the day. Items are specifically selected for a smart Catholic audience like you. Don't let the world take you by surprise. Subscribe to our daily media roundup at thecatholicassociation.org.
We'd like to take a moment to thank all of our loyal listeners who tune in each week to Conversations with Consequences. As you all know, the Catholic Association is everywhere. We were on TV to cover the conclave and the election of the new pope. We're in print, we're online, and we're on social media. We've just launched a new Substack to expand our media presence and offer more great content from a Catholic perspective. We're on X, and now we're on Substack for Catholic Conversations with TCA, where we're featuring exciting new interviews, commentaries, videos, and more, featuring our fellows, Ashley McGuire, Lee Sneed, and Betsy Fentress. And we'll be having guest columnists each week as well. Just recently, Ashley shared some little-known facts about Saint Carlo Acutis. Lee Sneed writes about her book on infertility, titled Infertile But Fruitful, and explains why she decided to write the book. So many people had responded to her columns and podcasts on her journey toward becoming an adoptive mother that she felt called to write a full-length book about it. And Betsy Fentress writes on hospitality and the will to live about a friend's father and a family friend with no relatives who were brought back to life by food, attention, and love. We hope you'll subscribe to our Substack. It's free. You'll find it at catholicassociation.substack.com, and we'd love for you to join us in our continuing Catholic conversations.
Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Ashley McGuire, and we are joined by our wonderful TCA chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry, who I haven't spoken to in a while. Betsy's been hogging you, so it's nice to be speaking with you again, Monsignor. I wish it were on a more positive topic, but it's one that I think we really do need to discuss, which is this unprecedented attack of President Trump on Pope Leo. And so I'll ask you the question that I've been asked on many interviews, which is simply, what was your reaction to seeing what President Trump said about the Holy Father?
I'll get there in a second. First, happy Easter, Ashley. Great to be back with you as well. There's no doubt now that President Trump is severely spiritually ill. And we need to pray for our president always, regardless of what party he is, regardless of whether we like certain of his policy decisions or not. But it is quite clear, we've seen it throughout the Easter season, that he is profoundly ill. On Easter Sunday, he basically talks about bombing Iran back to the Stone Age. And then on Divine Mercy Sunday, it's evident how much he needs God's mercy in his own life, that he decides to attack the vicar of Christ on earth. And like, he's not a Catholic. He doesn't necessarily have to believe that Pope Leo is the vicar of Christ on earth, as Catholics do believe. But he is clearly a religious figure. And that wasn't a policy disagreement that he put out in a late night rant via his Truth Social. That was an ad hominem attack. And unfortunately, our president, and listen, to be plain, I've liked a lot of the decisions President Trump has made about certain things. In his first term, he put Supreme Court justices that led to the overturning of Roe versus Wade. Let's give him credit for it. In the second term, he put an end to the real push for gender ideology by his courage and basically being able to state the truth that if someone is a man thinking he's trapped in a woman's body, that we should have compassion and pity for that person, but we shouldn't let that reorder the entire universe. Trump's done a lot of good things. At the same time, He did a total ad hominem attack against the Holy Father, using language that was insulting to somebody who, even if you don't want to believe what Catholics believe about Pope Leo was a good spiritual leader, and that the President of the United States would go so low and so vulgar as to insult the Holy Father that way was insulting basically everybody who looks to Pope Leo with spiritual reverence. And so certainly we need to pray for President Trump. We Catholics need to Catholics in the US have to take a certain responsibility. This is a choice that's becoming plain between the Vicar of Christ and the Vicar of Barabbas. Who's it going to be for us? That doesn't mean that the Pope is necessarily going to be right on every policy position and things like that. He's got no infallibility when it comes to the sort of practical concerns, but he is quite clear with regard to the principles that we need to apply to those circumstances. And President Trump, in his diatribe against Pope Leo, wasn't really saying, I've got a nice policy disagreement on immigration or about whether this war in Iran is unjust. He was making it quite personal and almost saying that anyone who disagrees with Donald J. Trump has to be wrong and is worthy of an attack. And so I think that there's some iconoclasm in that like, there is a megalomania, I'll say it, with regard to President Trump, that he sometimes wants to be treated as someone with absolute power and someone who never makes a mistake, because we've unfortunately never heard him apologize. He takes down a tweet in which he pretends he's Jesus Christ, bringing miracles to the sick and everything else like this, and lies to us yet once again, which is a chronically bad habit. And we know who the father of lies is. Lies to us yet again, thinking that it was a Red Cross post. And does anybody think that the President of the United States is that much of an imbecile that he didn't realize that he was trying to put out an image that made him look like Jesus? I mean, the whole type of thing has become exhausting. And it's time, just like he helped us to do with gender ideology, when we recognize that those who believe that they're trapped in the wrong sex, he helped us in society to realize that those people need some mental help. We now have got to come to the conclusion that our president is psychologically and spiritually very ill. This is not what normal people do. This is certainly not what good people do. This is what teenagers do at their worst. And Pope Leo's responded to President Trump like a grown-up. Again, we don't necessarily have to agree with Pope Leo on every practical thing, but he should not have to suffer this from the President of the United States, who debased his office and has put himself in a circumstance where Catholics in the United States, especially faithful Catholics who helped elect him the last time, are now going to be having serious questions about whether we've got somebody who's compos mentis in the White House. And I know that's very strong, but the way the president is behaving is not the way a sane leader behaves. And it's clearly not something that I think Catholics are going to look at and say, this man really represents me and my values if he's going to be doing such an ad hominem attack against the 267th Peter and the first pope from US shores.
You know, the way you describe what Trump is looking for sounds like infallibility, which is funny because there's so much misperception about papal infallibility. Can you tease out a little bit, because I think this is where some of the sticking points are. You know, some people have said, well, Pope Leo, he provoked this because, you know, he weighed in on a US political issue, and he should stay in his lane. Things like that, and also that, you know, this notion of whether or not Catholics are required, you know, what they're supposed to agree with or not, and whether the Pope is speaking infallibly. Can you tease out that a little bit? Because it seems really dangerous to me that suddenly we're seeing, even from conservatives, people arguing that the Catholic Church should not be weighing in on geopolitical matters or political matters at all.
If Pope Leo were to weigh in and say, I'm blessing what Trump is doing in Iran with both hands, nobody would be complaining. They're complaining because he's not on board with what President Trump has decided without the advice and consent of Congress, without the US people behind him to wage a war against Iran, recognizing that the whole world and future generations of Americans may have to pay the consequences of that. It's not that the Pope is weighing in on an issue with political ramifications. He's weighing in on a moral issue. War is a moral issue, and it needs to be up for moral justification. And the reason why people are upset is because they don't like the fact that he's trying to pump the brakes on what's happening. It's a similar thing with immigration. That when Pope Leo has been asked questions, it's not that he's written a letter unsolicited or anything else like this. When he has been asked questions, he's responded to the questions. Now, there might be some people who want the Pope just simply to say, no comment. That's a political issue in the US. How dare I comment on anything? Nobody in those criticizing Pope Leo in this case would really care all that much if he were to intervene with regard to pro-life positions or other things like that. People would expect it and not be surprised. But because he is the conscience of the globe, saying the way we're handling various of our immigration things are not consistent with morality. That doesn't mean you can't have borders, safe, orderly, and regular immigration proceedings, that there's a difference between legal and illegal, that there can't be deportations. He's not saying any of that. But he's basically saying, are we really treating our brothers and sisters with humanity? And then people who recognize that some of the positions of the administration with regard to the way we've treated individual immigrants, legal or illegal in the country, and even citizens who happen to come from foreign countries, acting and moving them even before we have all the information, that's less than what's consistent with their dignity. People don't like those types of interventions. And that's really where this is coming from, that the Pope's not on their side. He's not blessing everything that they're doing with regard to immigration or with regard to war, for example, because these are the two most pressing concerns about which people are being forced to choose between allegiance to a political philosophy with regard to these issues, not to mention some cases to political decisions that were made. That if the Holy Father's not on that side, it is going to ping the conscience, and it should ping the conscience. Doesn't mean the Pope's always right. These are applying principles to concrete circumstances, and the application can be wrong. That's not covered by infallibility for certain. But nevertheless, he has a very well-informed opinion morally, and his opinion should matter to every Catholic. And if he's saying that there are some moral problems with what we're doing with regard to the situation in Iran or with the situation within our borders or at our borders, everyone, not just Catholics, but everyone should be asking, are we doing everything the right way? Not whether we've got justification to do something, but in the actual execution of the game plan, are we doing it in a moral way? And we need to be humble enough to re-examine in those circumstances, and then engage if we have to on some of the principles. But there is a just war tradition, and just war tradition is very clear. And to me, the presidential administration has not made any real attempt to justify it. There have been people who are foolishly on the conservative side tried to say, well, if we stretch things, it might be possible for us to justify if Iran were to have the stuff for a nuclear weapon and we distrust them and everything else. Sure. But every time we say that, what's happening today is that's more or less being used to justify the prosecution of the war as it's been taking place, including with words that are threatening on Easter to bomb a civilization back into the Stone Age. I mean, if we're trying to say that it possibly could be justified, that doesn't mean this is justified, especially as persecution. So we've got a lot of these issues coming in. For a Catholic, I think we always have to listen to the Holy Father in terms of considering what he's saying. We need in our own prayer to be able to see whether those principles apply to these circumstances. And we should never begin to say that because the president of the United States doesn't like to be criticized and goes on a full frontal ad hominem attack, even including against members of his administration who put forward some objections to things, we shouldn't be intimidated to do that. We are the disciples of the one who has conquered the world. And despite the president's now taken down X image of his portraying himself as Jesus, he's not Jesus. And we owe to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. And that's not absolute allegiance. That's prayers. That's respect. But we owe to God what belongs to God. And for us as Catholics, that means we're always going to take into consideration what the Holy Father himself is proposing with regard to the morality of particular issues, not to the practicality necessarily of all those issues, but to the morality that's involved. We want never to be in a circumstance in which we're turning off our ears, because in doing so, we may be turning off our ears to Jesus Christ himself. Is there any of us who would say, Donald, I want you bombing Iran into the smithereens? Or is there any of us who really think God would be saying, treat immigrants this way because I've already told you I was a stranger and you're welcome me? And so Pope Leo is serving as a prophet today. And many of the times the prophets are killed. And President Trump tried a verbal assassination on Divine Mercy Sunday of all places. And to be blunt, Ashley, because I'm just righteously angry against what Trump put out that night. As priests, we regularly see people who are tortured by unexpiated guilt. And they don't even know where it begins. And there are all types of behavior over the course of time that if they're not regularly receiving God's mercy and that fresh start that God wants to give us, it can compound, it can impact the way they think, it can impact their will, it can impact their decisions. And I think that what the president was doing in that rant on Divine Mercy Sunday was a cry of desperation for actual help. He was taking on an icon on earth of the divine, that we actually have a person who represents Jesus Christ the Messiah as the successor of Saint Peter. And there was an iconoclasm that went against this person who is a sacred person and went after him in an ad hominem way. And this is not coming from virtue and grace. And so we need to pray for our president. That's my main message, because he really needs God's mercy and he needs the humility to admit when he makes mistakes and humbly say sorry. And the very fact that he is kind of like a modern day Arthur Fonzarelli from Happy Days, who could never say the word sorry, even when everybody else will tell him he made a mistake, is a sign of the type of pride and hubris which often presages a collapse, a really deep fall. And we don't want our whole country to fall with the vices of POTUS 47.
Well, we just have a few more minutes, but I don't want to overlook the Holy Father's trip in Africa right now. He's in Algeria. Can you speak a little bit about the various martyrs that he was honoring, and just, the significance of this trip to these countries in Africa?
This is the largest of his trips up until now. We hope he's going to be our Holy Father for many years and we'll have many long trips, including to the United States of America. But he's going to four different countries in Africa. He began in Algeria, which is where Saint Augustine, his spiritual father, he's an Augustinian monk originally, where Saint Augustine comes from. So he had a very moving visit to the place where St. Augustine used to serve in Hippo. He honored all the martyrs of Tiburtine, these Trappist monks who were killed by Islamists for doing nothing other than not being fundamentalist Muslims. These are the most peaceful people you would have, who spend their whole life in a monastery praying for their people in their surroundings. And so Pope Leo went to basically honor their witness of prayer, their witness of love for Algeria and all the Algerian people, regardless of what their religion is, their ultimate love for God, and trying to bring a little bit of the peace that comes from God to Algeria. I'm very happy he went there. Today, as we're recording this interview, he's left for Cameroon, a country that needs a peacemaker, because the English-speaking part of the country and the French-speaking part of the country have had some very difficult disagreements, and there's more or less a civil war going on in Cameroon. From there, he's going to go to Angola, a Portuguese colony, which is very, very poor, and then to Equatorial Guinea, a Spanish colony. So he's united all of Africa, more or less, by this visit. He's gone to a place in which you speak Arabic and French, then to a country that speaks French and English, then to a country that speaks Portuguese, then to a country that speaks Spanish. And so you're going to have our Holy Father speaking all of those languages, praying with the people in each of those countries, trying to bring the light of Christ and the hope that comes from knowing that God with us is with us still, to this place of great Christian growth in the midst of persecution and in the midst of poverty. And so I'd urge everybody to try to follow this trip, because he's not just speaking in four different languages to Africans. He's speaking in the languages of the world to the people of the world about the path that really leads to the type of peace and unity among all the creatures of God that we all deeply long for. Especially during this Easter season, when Christ says to us, risen from the dead, peace be with you. And so, in the midst of a world now revulsing in conflict, often precipitated by one person, we need somebody else who's not just a peace talker, but a peace wisher, who's never asked himself to win the Nobel Peace Prize. He's just going out there trying to bring peace to these countries that definitely need a little bit of direction. And so his message will transcend their national boundaries.
Well, we're so grateful for the Holy Father, and he needs our prayers because, goodness, he's under attack on all fronts. And we thank you, Monsignor, for breaking this down for us and helping us to better understand how to process this painful episode. It's painful for Catholics, but it's also beautiful to see the Holy Father just moving forward and continuing to bring the message of the gospel throughout the world. So, thank you, Monsignor, so much for your insights and your wisdom.
Welcome, Ashley. We pray for the president. We pray for our Holy Father. But we've got to remember that, like, if President Trump attacked our mother, even though some of the times we might disagree with our mother, we would rightly, most of us at least, I hope, stick up for our mom. And that's what we're doing. We would do it even if our mom, or in this case, our Holy Father, were wrong. But in this case, he's right. Not on every particular, but he's right on the principles. And now's the time for us to speak up with one voice. And thanks for the opportunity to speak, Ashley. I hope I didn't offend anybody. I didn't mean to offend anybody. But these are the types of outrageous and egregious things that, if we don't denounce them as they deserve, they'll just propagate even more. And it's time for all of us to say enough.
Amen. Thank you, Monsignor.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, where I am joined by Monsignor Roger Landry, our TCA chaplain. And we are here to talk about a very exciting beatification happening in the United States in September. Monsignor Landry, take it away.
2 weeks ago, on the solemnity of the Annunciation of the Lord, as we were pondering the Archangel Gabriel's great words to Mary, we were able to apply them to another context. Rejoice, you have been filled with grace, the Lord is with you, as the Vatican published the date that we would be able to lift my predecessor, Fulton J. Sheen, the former national director of the Pontifical Mission Societies for 16 years, to the altars. And so that will take place September 24th, which is the day in which the church prays for China, because It's the Feast of Our Lady of Mercy, who was the title of the image of Our Lady that the Chinese have been most devout to over the course of the centuries. And so Archbishop Sheen had an extraordinary love for the Christians in China, wrote about them a lot, was very concerned about the persecutions that they began to endure during his tenure as the national director, not to mention historically. And so it's going to be a chance for all of us to think about the evangelization of China and pray for it, just as I'm sure soon to be blessed Fulton J. Sheen will be interceding from heaven. It's also on a Thursday, which is a little strange rather than a Saturday, but that came, frankly, because the Diocese of Peoria had submitted various dates that would work, and the first priorities were all Saturdays. But then they had included some other days in which the Dome in St. Louis would be available. And anytime you do that, I tell that to every listener of Consecration with Consequences, they say that this would be a good day. And so they chose a Thursday, which might make it a little bit more challenging for Catholic families with students in schools to attend if they're beyond the sort of geographical region of St. Louis. But there's a fittingness likewise to a Thursday in which Catholics always ponder the Holy Eucharist on Thursday because we had the Last Supper on a Thursday. And Fulton J. Sheen is the greatest preacher in the history of the church on the importance of a Eucharistic holy hour. If it is really Jesus in our tabernacles and in our monstrances, and of course it is, why wouldn't we want to make time for him? And so Sheen always was urging everybody who would ever come with him on retreat, bishops, priests, deacons, religious, Catholic laymen, Catholic laywomen, young people, everybody, he would urge them to do what he himself began to do with a promise on the day of his priestly ordination, September 20th, 1919. He said every day of his life he would make a Eucharistic holy hour. He would spend 60 minutes in the presence of Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament. And he was so proud as he got to the end of his life that he had been able to keep that promise. And he said, lots of people wonder where the fire comes in the pulpit. It comes from that holy hour with Jesus, he says. Lots of people have wondered where the eloquence comes from. It's by my sitting or kneeling in front of the word. Everybody asks, like, the fruit of the missions and everything else. He says, it's a consequence of the intercession before Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament. So there's great fittingness, likewise, that it's going to happen on a Thursday there, September 24th, in St. Louis. When John Paul II came there in 1999, they jammed 103,000.
I was there.
Yeah, I was in Rome. I would have been there had I not been in Rome studying to be a priest. But I remember following it, and some of the great photos of St. John Paul II come from 1999 there in the Dome in St. Louis. And so 103,000 were able to be fit there. We'll see how many tickets we're able to give out, but I'm very grateful. I think we're going to start by distributing about 70,000 tickets. But if there's greater need, we're happy to know that the Dome had the largest indoor crowd of all time at that mass in January in 1999 with St. John Paul II.
Well, we are all very excited about this, and we look forward to lots more information from you. And I hope you're going to reissue any books that maybe might not be in print.
Well, we've got so many publishers who are contacting me asking for permission, and that's pretty easy. And then lots of them are asking me to write books over the course of these next months or put together things. That's going to be much harder as I'm doing the other parts of my job. But if there are other listeners on Conversations with Consequences who love Sheen as much as we do, there's a huge opportunity of interest for us to be talking about Sheen and his continual relevance to the growth of the faith in the United States and across the globe.
Thank you so much, Monsignor Landry.
Happy Easter.